And now, Move the Sticks with Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Move the Sticks. DJ Bucky back with you. This is Move the Sticks presented by Zaxby's. I should point that out, by the way. Buck, how you doing, man?
Man, I'm good. I am good. Coming off a strong Monday night performance from the Las Vegas Raiders. It's still hard for me to call them Las Vegas after them playing in Oakland for so long. Yeah, it's been a great week, man. Great weekend. A lot of good ball. It's just kind of funny to see how teams, some teams have like hit the ground running, like the Baltimore Ravens, like they're in stride. And other teams are kind of limping out the gate where they're still trying to figure out the mechanisms to be able to play a game. And it just kind of makes you want to tap into those people and see what were the differences in their practice and training camp approaches. Because it does appear that some guys kind of have it figured out, where other coaches and other teams certainly do not have it figured out.
Yeah, it's a great call. There's been some teams, I think it'd be interesting to see if it correlates to how physical they were in camp, which we had talked about some teams taking a more physical approach. I know obviously the Ravens have that reputation. You know, the Chiefs, we've talked about them being a physical team during training camp in the past as well. So that'd be interesting to get that information. But man, we've got a lot of ground to cover today. I want to hit on that game. You mentioned it, Raiders big win over the Saints. I want to talk about an interesting trend with some teams and what they're doing under center and the value that you get from being under center. We want to talk about our buddy Deion Sanders getting a new coaching job. We've got the conversation that we were having on Twitter about being able to attack in coverage, linebackers and safeties, and what does that mean for scouting? And I feel like it's something we've been talking about for several years. We'll get there. I'll save that till we get there. But I don't want to spoil it. But how about last night? Your big takeaways from that game last night with the Raiders?
My big takeaway, John Gruden is playing the style of football that he envisioned. The defense isn't perfect, but from an offensive standpoint, this is the John Gruden version of offense that he's always wanted to play. And so what you're seeing is a big, beefy offensive line that can maul people. You're seeing a running game led by a dominant runner who never really has to come off the field because he also can be a factor in the passing game. You're seeing a quarterback who is efficient, getting the ball out of his hands, but is very, very good working off play action. And then the only difference is you're seeing a number one pass catcher that is a tight end, not a wide receiver. But Darren Waller is an absolute star, and he is a problem. Obviously, we've talked about him before, but, man, he is a handful. And what you're seeing, the Raiders control the game with their offense. You look at time of possession, it was nearly double. You look at the amount of plays, it was almost double. They control the ball with their offense, and that is the way they have to play, because you want to play great defense, play fewer snaps of defense. That's the way to get it done.
Yeah, I mean, it was impressive. And I want to go back to Josh Jacobs because we talked a lot about him in the run-up to the draft. I remember when I put out my first top 50 list, Buck, and he was in my top 10 from start to finish, people lost their minds. And then he went out and ran 4.62, and people said, you can't do that. As a running back, he ran 4.62. You mentioned it. He is the engine there for that offense. I mean, he makes that whole thing go. And it's because he's physical. He's instinctive. He's got vision. He's got balance. He can help you in the passing game. Like, he's everything that you need to be that, you know, lack of a better phrase, that kind of bell cow runner for your team. And I think he's given them an identity offensively.
Yeah, and I think the big thing that I struggled with Josh Jacobs was maybe the lack of production over years, meaning he was basically like a one-year starter who kind of did it at Alabama. And so you're like, man, how good is he? But I think, how good is he really? But I think what I've learned from that, I'm going to take Josh Jacobs, and then I'm going to back that up further, and I'm going to say Alvin Kamara.
They were on the field in that game together last night. It was ironic.
And I think they're the two examples now that scouts can reference when you have those debates in meeting rooms. Because before, it was like, hey, I want to see his resume. How many years has he done? And Jonathan Taylor had a million carries and a million yards and those things. But we're seeing at the nature of the running back position, maybe it's better that they come in with fewer reps, fewer carries, because when they come into the league, I can load them down and know that maybe durability won't be a concern based on the mileage that they had prior to reaching the National Football League.
Cool. Can I look at it this way and say, if you've shown me that you can do it, if I know you can do it, I don't need necessarily see you do it a million times. I know you can do it. That's number one. But then number two, don't you think the wiring, right? When they have the proper makeup and wiring, and then you can say, okay, I know he can physically do it, And then I know he has the want to be able to work, to be able to get to where we want him to be. Like, to me, that's like the beautiful combination when you have somebody that has the talent and the work ethic. Once you can fill in the rest of the gaps, there's going to be gaps. If you look at each evaluation like a sheet, right? Like a coloring sheet. Mm-hmm. It's not all colored in. You don't get to see it all colored in when you get it. But if you can look at it and say, okay, he's got the ability, he's got the want to, he's got the makeup, we can fill in the rest once he gets here.
Yeah, and I think that running back position, one, I think you have to throw speed out of the equation when it comes to running back. It's been proven, like, the fast that you run has no effect on the kind of runner that you are. Like, it's great when you can say that, hey, you're Chris Johnson that runs 4.3. But over time, we've seen the explosive runners. Maybe on a great year, you may have 4-6, 40-plus yard runs. The game is not really played in that. It's really in the 5-10 yard box. Can you make people miss? Can you punish people when you have the opportunity? Can you deliver 10-plus yard plays? That's kind of where you want to measure them. The other thing, the running back position, in my estimation, is the easiest for a young player to get on the field with a rock in his hand. Now, when it comes to pass protection, that's a different animal than a beast. But in terms of just being a pure runner or pass catcher, I think it's easier for young guys to play. And so when you think about a Josh Jacobs or even an Alvin Kamara, when they came in without those reps, well, the one thing that you could look at with Josh Jacobs, well, if we ask him to do exactly what he did at Alabama, that's going to give him a chance to be a 15 to 20 touch per game guy. Alvin Kamara was outstanding catching the ball out the backfield. So I know at least I'm getting a third down back. I think it's really, from an evaluation standpoint, looking at every player at running back and being able to clearly say, coach, here's exactly what he can do when we bring him into our program. And then let's see if we can build upon that when he gets here. But here's why he can get on the field and why he's worthy of being an early down or specialty back or whatever that is.
I want to give you another thought here, Buck, when we flip it over to the defensive side, because a guy that was one of our favorites in the run-up to that draft that same year who lost his rookie year was Jonathan Abram. We had him on. He's awesome. You know, loved his energy. And it got me thinking defensively. Like I've told the story about how in Baltimore we had the STI, right? Speed, toughness, instincts, and those are the three things you really hone in on. Defensively, I almost think it's like maybe it's extra credit. You know, maybe it doesn't belong in those top three. But man, you see it with Jamal Adams, and I went on Aftermath and showed some of the issues he had in coverage, but it's the energy. That's a talent. Energy is a gift. I've seen it with Derwin James when he's been healthy with the Chargers. We see it with Jamal Adams, what he's done for the Seahawks on the defensive side of the ball. Jonathan Abram has brought that energy to that defense. And man, I think especially in empty stadiums that we have this year, it's never been more important than to have somebody, hopefully multiple guys, that bring the juice. And I think Jonathan Abrams brought some juice to that defense.
DJ, I think we both are still kind of old school in our beliefs based on what we were exposed to very early in our scouting careers. Old school mentality was you had to have an intimidator. You had to have an enforcer somewhere in the middle of the field, be it at Mike linebacker, be it at safety, one of those safeties. Somebody had to be able to force running backs and wide receivers to pay their taxes for venturing in between the hashes. Now, when the league changed the rules, there was a rush to kind of remove those players, those box players or those hard hitters, because you wanted the athlete that could cover. He could come down over the slot. But what you're seeing, particularly with the way that they're calling games now, that player has value because those hits really discourage people from venturing into those areas. They also energize your squad when you have a player that can come up and kind of stick their face in the fan and make a big hit. Those things matter because when you're dealing with humans and human emotions, there's nothing like, from a defensive standpoint, putting a ooh-wee shot on someone that kind of sparks up the rest of the thing because it's contagious, because then others are trying to do it. And I'm sure you saw it in Baltimore with Ray Lewis and all those guys around. When they start making plays, it becomes a feeding frenzy, and it's really hard to deal with a defense that has that.
Yeah, I think the thing that's changed probably with the rules and is that now those hits are coming against the run, or they're coming in the alley, right? Where it used to be those collisions would take place in the middle of the field. That's getting called now. If you hit somebody in the middle of the field, it's going to get called. So you lose a little bit of that value. But those guys being able to drop down, shoot alleys and fill gaps and be able to stick their face in the fan, as you said, that to me still has tremendous value. The challenge, here's the thing. You want to try and find guys like that. To me, is the difference between Derwin and Jamal. Like Derwin can do that, but then Derwin can match up a little bit more in coverage. It's being able to get the advantage of what they give you with that physicality coming forward without having to deal with the liability when they're going backward. I think Jonathan Abram, now I haven't studied this tape yet, mm-hmm. but from what we saw of him in college in Mississippi State, I think he's got the ability to play high and do some coverage things as well as drop down and give you that physicality that we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting thing when it comes to evaluating and pegging safeties, because I almost believe that we're going to have to split safeties and maybe even a three-category feature where you have the high safety, which is your normal center field safety, your playmaker, yeah. the guy that would be like Earl Thomas in his prime. And then you're going to have the strong safety or the type that is more like, you would say, Derwin James, that can play in the box but also maybe move out to the slot. And in the third category, I'm going to call it the hybrid or the nickel backer, which is he's listed as a safety, but in essence, because so many teams are playing nickel, he's really that third linebacker. That's what Jamal Adams is to me. Jamal mm-hmm. Adams is kind of like that guy that is the fringe box player, because when you watch that game, man, how many times did he come off the edge as a pass rusher? Like when we talk about the Seattle Seahawks,
yeah.
they don't have a true pass rusher up front. So what they've done is they've made 33 their fifth pass rusher. So he comes, man, it seems like he's coming like 15 to 20 times a game off the edge. yeah. And yeah. that's his value. And so when we think about that three-prong approach at safety, it's the high safety, it's the guy that is the versatile drop-down guy, and then really it's the nickel backer safety that is the role that Jamal is playing, but also a guy like Jeremy Chinn would play, mm-hmm. kind of the puffed up oversized, but he's going to spend most of his time 8 to 10 yards within the line of scrimmage.
All right. I need help with the last word here because I love doing the three same letters, right? We did it with the three P's, right? For play callers, protection, playmakers. So I'm thinking of these three safeties, right? Fill, you need one that can fill. You need one that can float, which is to float over the top. Now I got to come up with the third F to be able to cover in the slot. Maybe it's a flexibility. Maybe it's
it might be a flex player. I think it is yeah. a flex player, because going all the way back when I was working in Seattle, there was a great secondary coach, Dick Roach. And Dick Roach said, and I mean, this is early 2000s. He said the perfect secondary is one where you basically have one safety and three corners. And yep. that guy that is your strong safety is really another corner. And he said the perfect guy at the time, you have to go all the way back. He said Sean Springs is the perfect safety, because at yeah. the time, Sean Springs was considered a big corner at like 6'1", maybe 6'2", 200, 210 pounds, big physical, could run. And so that's kind of what the league is evolving to, because as more teams go to 11 personnel with three receivers on the field, if you can have a guy that can stay on the field and drop down over that slot receiver, well, now you can play base. Now you can do what you really want to do on defense.
Maybe there's three C's. Maybe it's cover, crash, and I don't know what the high safety with the C. I've been workshopping that. I'm gonna get that by the next episode. We're gonna have that.
So yeah, you got the center fielder.
Oh, center fielder.
Yeah, you got the center fielder.
Center fielder. Then you got one that can cover, and you got one that can crash.
Yeah, because the crash off the edge, yeah. like literally, yeah. DJ, like you're seeing these guys add more. The secondary blitz part of it, haven't had a chance to study, but it has popped up on tape. You're seeing this year, more than ever, more sub blitzes, meaning nickel yeah. corners, safeties coming, or whatever, because more teams are using these unique and exotic fronts, whether it's your nickel, 4-2-5, 3-3-5, 2-4-5. Like they're using a variety of combinations to put different people on the field, because it is a problem for the offense to identify, who do I set the protection on? Who is the quote-unquote Mike? And when you have all these DB numbers floating around the box and any one of those guys can do it, it is a problem. And you should know that from being in Baltimore with Rex Ryan yeah. and talking to Dennis Thurman, those guys, like that's how they're running the same blitz from multiple packages. But with each package, it changes who the point man is.
Yep, exactly true. All right, let's flip it over real quick on the other side of this. Drew Brees, you worried?
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely worried. Like, he's lost his fastball. I think what was telling on the telecast, and look, give them credit, it's a hard job to do the Monday night thing, but I felt like they were soft-shoeing the Drew Brees conversation. Mm-hmm. Drew Brees, when they were saying Drew Brees can't step into his throws, he doesn't have mustard or whatever, I'm saying right now the best version of Drew Brees would be Greg Maddux, meaning that yeah. he's lost the velocity, but because he can paint the corner so well, he is still able to do it. But what we're seeing is Drew Brees has almost become a knuckleballer. He's almost Tim Wakefield.
He missed some layups last night, man.
Yeah, and so, TJ, it becomes a problem because, you know, when we start to evaluate, like, from a scouting standpoint, when you're doing the advanced scout, it takes about three games, four games before you really hone in. If he continues to put up that he can't push the ball down the field, you're talking shrinking the field. Because also, the Saints don't have any – they don't have any burners on the outside. And so they've been able to get away with it because they've been so great with their shallow cross, rub route packages that they can just run people into each other. And then Alvin Kamara has always been the guy that has been the one that can win because you get him matched up one-on-one on a weak side linebacker, he wins on the option route. So they would clear the side, go 3-by-1, Alvin Kamara on the one receiver side, and he would run the option route. He either runs the angle or he runs the quick out, and boom, it's a completion. Well, now if you double team him and you go tight man on everybody else, where are the outlets? That is when the offense becomes really, really sticky for the Saints. And I think Sean Payton is going to have to reconsider how they go about it. They may need to lean into the running game a little more and create what we talked about early, or maybe that was off air, the play action under center and try and get their shots like that. Because I don't know if he's going to be able to get it the way that he's always been able to get it in shotgun, all go special, pushing it down the field for verticals.
Yeah, the visual I would give you with what's going to happen if they don't prove that they can get up and get over the top is that it's like when you would go to the YMCA and you play 5-on-5 half court.
Oh, yeah.
Like, are we going to run this full? Like, some of the old guys don't want to run full. So, like, we're going to run half court.
So, are we going to play with all five?
This isn't even a regulation court, man. Like, we're going to play with all five guys. Here.
Yeah, all five guys. Woo. Yeah. We can't move. A lot of bumping and grinding. Yeah, so, like, but that's what's going to happen. And the reason we didn't see the Saints move, separate, or run away from the Raiders, because you kept thinking, like, okay, at some point they're going to run away from this game. Like, we're waiting for the old Saints. And they can't do it. Well, teams are going to look at the Raiders and say, well, if the Raiders can cover them, and I know Michael Thomas is there, we definitely are going to add more man-to-man, more pressure, more in their face, and see what it is. The other thing when it comes to being an older quarterback, and here's the thing about the older quarterbacks. When we got into the league, you didn't play quarterback when you're 40 years old.
No.
Your quarterback wasn't expected to be a 20-year option at the position. We got 10 years out of him. That was great. Then we saw guys play longer. Brett Favre was one of the first ones to really kind of play for a long time, and then it's continued. But now you're 20 years in, and the thing that happens is the hits hurt more. And so we're seeing Drew Brees, I don't want to say wince, but we're seeing him get rid of the ball.
Buck, this is week two. Quicker. This is week two. What's this going to look like in week 12?
It's going to be bad because his arm talent would start diminishing and deteriorating at the end of the year. And last year, he had a 5-week break, you know, where he could kind of put the arm on ice and kind of have a little juice left. If he goes 16 straight weeks, he's not going to be able to last and push it down the field. And I just wonder how much Sean Payton can do the mass, the deficiency, love the mind and the decision making. But now the physical ability may begin to have a toll on how they want to run their offense.
Well, you touched a little bit on it a second ago, talking about being under center and the advantages of being under center. I want to give you a couple numbers here for some of these teams in this Shanahan scheme and what they're doing. So you look at the Rams and how efficient they've been. Jared Goff under center, 20 for 27, averaging 10 yards an attempt, 2 touchdowns, no picks. You look at the Green Bay run game, the way they've been able to get that on track. Under center, Green Bay's averaging 6.1 yards per carry. So we're seeing some of these offenses. Obviously, Shanahan is under center a bunch. We've seen them. We saw them just destroy and demolish the Jets despite all the injuries that they had. But we're seeing teams that are under center have success, Buck. And I think about it from a general manager standpoint. If you are looking to hire a coach in the offseason, you know, you want to start first and foremost with the leader, right? You want to get the best leader you can get. But man, if you can craft your staff, that's the offense I'm running. Like that is the one that I'm running, is the Shanahan system where we're under center. And I'll let you explain some of the benefits of it.
Now, the Shanahan system is one of the greatest systems. I go all the way back to 97, 98 when the Denver Broncos won back to back. I was playing in the league. I played against them in 96 with the Jaguars, played for the Raiders against him, and it was problematic. Kansas City Chiefs too. Like, you couldn't stop it. And now they had a Hall of Fame running back in Terrell Davis. But the problem is in the run game, when you're dealing with the zone, the outside zone is really the stretch play. So they're running off tackle. The way that it's designed, you're aiming for the inside leg of the offensive tackle. And the guys give, like the running back is given three choices. It's bend it, bang it, and bounce it. So he either bends it back on the cutback, he bangs it up in there if there's nothing there, or he bounces it outside the corner. Those are the rules. It's a strict rule. You get to the line of scrimmage, and that's what it is. And when they're going in unison, it's really like watching elephants on parade. They're all in sync. They're just kind of stepping to their area, and they take anything that shows up, and they just kind of let you use your momentum against you. And then it's on the running back to find the lanes. The complementary passing game is so difficult because the line comes off the same way. The running back moves the same. And if you've been getting gutted in the run game, you're flying up. And now they come out of it either on a bootleg or on a long, exaggerated drop. And they're running these deep crossing routes, like deep post, deep over, tight end sliding down the line, leaking out the back door, down the boundary. The deep shots are tremendous. And so if you're not disciplined with your eyes, if you're not physical enough, the offense will absolutely expose your lack of discipline. And it doesn't take what I would call an A-level quarterback to perform well. The reason why you talk about it being the preferred system is because you can elevate quarterbacks in that system. You make the game so easy for them that I don't want to say you can win with anybody, but you can win with anybody. And if you get a good quarterback, you go to another level.
It brought up a good point. I was talking to a coach the other day, and we've had this conversation in the past, and he just reminded me of this too. He's like, you know, when we're looking at our advanced scouting reports every week, and you look at tendencies, right? And what teams like to do. And he said, it's amazing to me because I think on the outside, you think, man, you got to change up your tendencies and what you're doing. It's like, no. The good teams have tendencies because they have things they major in. They have things that they're good at and they don't care what you do. They're going to do what they do and be successful. He said, it's amazing. Every week when you look at the report, you're like, oh man, these guys have a lot of tendencies. Oh yeah, this team's undefeated. Yeah, because they do those things extremely well.
It is. And so, DJ, like, obviously from a high school coaching standpoint, like spend the offseason like looking at like team building, culture building or whatever. And like the common denominator with all of these businesses and companies that operate efficiently, they know what they know and they master that. So out west, we talk about In-N-Out. In the South, they'll talk about Chick-fil-A, where those two franchises are the best in the business because In-N-Out, they only make burgers. They don't try and make chicken tenders. They don't try and go out of their way. They have mastered the process of making the burger. And so if you do it over and over and over again, you get really good at it. Same thing with Chick-fil-A. You get great at making chicken sandwiches. The lemonade is what it is. You go there. You know exactly what you're ordering. It doesn't take a whiz to figure out the menu. It's very small and it works. Well, so for the Shanahan system, look, they run two running plays, inside zone, outside zone. That's pretty much it. And so the benefit of that is the fewer variables that you bring into the equation, the more you're able to answer the thing. So if I only do this, well, I begin to know, well, they only can stop it a handful of ways. So we're going to spend all of our practice time working against what we know we're going to face, as opposed to having more plays, which brings about more counters from the defense, which now do I have enough practice time to fully prepare my team? And so there's some benefit to that. But you're right. Great teams have tendencies. They know who they are and they're okay. And if you beat us doing what we do, we tip our hat. We go on to the next game.
Yep, it's true. And by the way, all this talk about food's got me craving a little Zaxby's here. I'm hungry, man. Zaxby's, our kind sponsor. We got to get some food out of this deal, man. We do. We'll be like, sitting here doing the pod.
Yeah, you know
what
they're
chicken.
They're known for their chicken tenders and stuff like that. Like that.
Yeah,
that,
give me some tenders.
You can get to like the bag. That's what it's for, you know?
We got to get that. Come on, Zaxby's. Let's go. Let's get some tenders this way. All right. Hey, I want to ask you your thoughts on our buddy Prime here, Deion Sanders, taking the Jacksonville State job. Your thoughts?
Love it. And knowing Prime really well and calling him kind of like a mentor, friend, a buddy, text him yesterday about it. And I knew this was in the works for a long time because he had said a few months ago that he had some coaching opportunities, but he had to take care of business. It was important. I don't know if people realized it, like a few months ago, he graduated, he got his undergraduate degree. And so to be a college coach, you have to have your undergraduate degree. That's one of the requirements. So he took care of that, checked off the box. He's been coaching down in Texas for a long time, over a decade, been with a very successful. A couple of private schools, the school that he's at now, Trinity Christian, they've won 3 straight state titles, and they do it in splendid fashion with him being the offensive coordinator, even though we all know he's basically the head coach. Like, when he's involved, he's the guy that's kind of running the show. And so going to Jackson State, I think is interesting. It's interesting on a couple of different things. One, he took an opportunity that some would not take. He went to an HBCU, a SWAC school, Jackson State, down in Jackson, Mississippi, where he doesn't necessarily have ties, but he wanted the opportunity to be a head coach. Two, what it does is it'll shed a lot of light on HBCU's programs and the players that are in those programs. It should be a boon because now he will attract a lot of attention. TV will naturally go where he's at. Scouts will also tend to go where all the attention and all the chaos, because you could get more things. And I think the bigger thing now is the debate that we often have, can former players, great former players, mm-hmm. be coaches, be successful head coaches? Because sometimes when you're a great player, you've been allowed
Magic
to
Johnson?
Skip. Yeah, you've been allowed to skip steps. And so sometimes it's hard for you to convey what made you great to others who don't have those same gifts.
Yeah.
And so that is typically the challenge when you're dealing with like a great former player. He's so great. He's been able to skip steps. His talent was able to maybe allow him to do it. That's why typically when we see head coaches, they kind of come from a different lane. Maybe they were the journeyman player. Maybe they didn't play at all or whatever. So they had to do it. So
the NFL is backup quarterback. That's the most popular head coach choice, is the backup quarterback.
Yeah. And so it'll be interesting to see what he does. But I think it's going to be fascinating to watch him take over that program. I think it's fascinating to put him in Mississippi, where you have Lane Kiffin in one corner, you have Mike Leach in another corner. You have enough talent in that state and neighboring that he could make a dent in recruiting. And the one thing that I've always wondered, if you had an HBCU program with a magnetic coach who was a great mm-hmm. recruiter, who could maybe entice some guys that typically would go to Power Five schools or those things to come down and take a chance on the program, you just wonder what that would look like. Typically at HBCUs, you're dealing with a lack of resources. You don't have the right facilities, and the money is not.
He's going to raise money.
Yeah,
he'll raise money.
Yeah, it's hard to get coaches and all that other stuff. But if you can figure that part out, it is a very, very interesting scenario.
Yeah, my thoughts on that with Prime. First of all that time he's spent in Texas is going to benefit him, because that's a pipeline, right? And so he's going to have relationships in that state to be able to get some kids. You know, you're not going to get the kids that were Division I kids, but you're going to get some good players because you're going to know coaches and have good relationships. So he can fall back, rely on that, number one. Number two, to me, if you are any secondary player, right, that is not happy where you are, you're at Texas A&M, you're at Mississippi State, you're at wherever you are, he should be the prime, no pun intended, transfer mm-hmm. option for those kids to be able to come in. You're going to get on the field and you're going to get coached by a guy who did it better than anybody else.
Oh, absolutely. Those contacts and connections are significant, because we know, like, Prime was very, very involved in the Under Armour All-American game. He's coached a ton of those players. He's had those players come to his Prime 21 camp. You talk about the ties that he has in Texas. One, being Prime, being a star for the Dallas Cowboys. Two, being a successful coach in that area. He knows a lot of people. And so he's going to be able to tap into some resources, not only in Texas, but also in Florida, to get some kids to play for him. It's going to be a very, very interesting deal to kind of see him. And I think what's funny is he's going from – he will complete his high school season to then playing a spring season at Jackson State. I wonder how he delegates and manages, but he's had to do that because he had to juggle his NFL Network responsibilities with being a high school coordinator and those things. I'm just curious to see who else he puts on his staff and who he has around.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see how he does. We'll be rooting for him again. He's been a mentor and a close friend of yours. He's always been incredibly kind and nice to me as well. And he's Deion Sanders. I mean, it. For growing up, when we grew up, Buck, I mean, there was nobody cooler on the planet than Prime.
Oh, I know. It's such a funny thing to do it. But yeah, like I think he'd do a fantastic job. He gets the right amount of time and they exhibit enough patience, because he's turned around a program that hasn't had a winning season in a while. If he gets it, I think he's going to eventually be successful there. But I will say this, that conference that he's in, I mean, there's some really good coaches. One of those guys that I talk about, I don't know, you remember backup quarterback at Clemson, Willie Simmons?
No.
Yeah, so Willie Simmons is a very, very successful coach down at Florida A&M. He is an offensive
FAMU
guru. Yeah.
I lost to FAMU in the playoffs one year.
Yeah, they throw it all over the yard, and they've just made the move to the SWAC after being in the MEAC for a while. It'll be interesting. It definitely will interesting journey.
Not my best start. I mean, we're playing FAMU, right? It's up in Boone. We got a home game. I think we're the we had to be the number 2 seed maybe in the Division I AA playoffs. So they're like the 15 seed. And so they're coming to Boone. Now, FAMU, obviously, and people don't know this, but up in Boone, North Carolina, you do, being around there, it's freezing during
it's
the winter.
Super cool.
And Buck, we were just like, man, it's going to be, hopefully it's snowing. These Florida guys not going to want anything to do with this cold weather. It was a Chamber of Commerce day. Like, it was 50 degrees, sun was out. I was like, you got to be kidding me. They come out in there. It was Jawan Sider, I think, was the quarterback who played in the Arena League forever. They threw it all over the yard on us. I turned the ball over. I was terrible. We lost in the first round of FAMU. It was bad, man.
You know, essentially, it's a different style of ball, man. And I'm sure if you ever get a chance, if our listeners ever get a chance to kind of see some of the ball that takes place, normally around Thanksgiving time, they would always do the Bayou Classic or whatever. But if you ever get a chance to look at it, man, there's some good players. It's a different style. It's wide open offense kind of rules the roost in those conferences. So you see a lot of high scoring, a lot of high flyers, a lot of skill, talent. So it'll be interesting to see what Deion is able to do there.
And if you want any more information on our buddy Deion taking the job at Jackson State, be sure to check out the Huddle and Flow podcast with our friends Jim Trotter and Steve Weich. Actually had Doug Williams, HBCU legend, on to talk about what this could mean going forward for the HBCUs. We talked about it previously when we had Steve and Jim on our pod, and they extend that conversation with the Super Bowl winning quarterback, Doug Williams.
I want to ask you something, because this came up, and I know we've kind of had talks about analytics, and you brought up the thing about under center. But I want to get your take on, there's been a little bit of debate, because I know you probably didn't see the game because you were prepping and doing the Charger game, but the Dallas Cowboys at the end of the game, it was about 5 minutes left in the game. They score a touchdown. They're down 15 points. Mm-hmm. Mike McCarthy elects to go for 2 at that point. They don't get it. They're down 15. They score, so they cut it to 9. He goes for 2, doesn't get it, so they're down 9. So now you need 2 possessions with about 4 minutes left. And so it's been debated, because the quants, the analytics people, are telling you, oh, you want to go early so you know exactly what you have to chase and how to play out the last game. For me, and I understand
the game. I was always taught extend the game.
Extend the game, because it's like basketball to me. It's like basketball in terms of, hey, we're down late. Hey, let's start the free throw shooting contest early so we can kind of
put the pressure on them.
Right. And so my explanation would be, the reason why you don't go for 2 on the first attempt is because if you make the game an 8-point game, for the Atlanta Falcons, when they get the ball coming back, they still have to play real offense. They still have to, hey, man, we can't really run it all the way. We may have to throw it. That gives you an opportunity to potentially stop the clock with the incompletion, get a play off an interception or anything. When you're up 9 and you're calling offense, well, now I'm thinking, okay, how much time is left? Let's take 40 seconds, multiply it times 3.
I can coach on the sidelines doing this.
Yes.
Stretch.
I can take 2+ minutes off the clock, punt it back, and then what are the odds that the other team is going to score, get the onside kick, and do it? Now, it worked out, but you can't make those decisions based on the result. Man, when you're playing the odds, you want to give yourself the most time. Now, the scenario that I think people should talk about is, if it's 14 points and you go for 2, in that scenario, I think that is the right call. Because if you're down 14, you score, you go for 2, now you cut the lead to 6, you can win the game with a kick. If you don't get it, it doesn't matter. You just do a 2-point conversion again, you tie it. And because the 2-point conversion is 50-50, it's like 47%. You play those odds. You go twice, you're typically going to get 1 out of 2. And so it's just one of those things where on Twitter, like, you have the quants and the analytics people saying, oh, you got to go right now. I'm like, no, time and score and context matters when you make these decisions.
I think it comes down to applying pressure. You know, you keep it's hope. It's two words. It's hope and pressure. And number one, it keeps your hope alive. You're a one score game. So you have continue to have hope. But I think it applies pressure to the other team versus, like you said, if it's a two score game, I think they handle themselves a little bit differently. But, you know, look, that there's the numbers people that look at what strictly at the numbers. I get where their explanation is. I just think that you're taking out emotion. And I think emotion pressure is a real thing. And
it's a real thing. It's a
big time
impact
on how they operate.
For the play caller, because DJ, we're coaching together, and okay, I'm like, DJ, what do you think? How do we want to take this? All right, look, it's 3 minutes left. How do we want to play this out when we have the ball? Do we want to run it the first two downs and throw on third down? Do we want to run it all three downs? Like, what is our approach? How many timeouts do they have left? Like, all of those things factor into it. How many timeouts do I have left? Like, that determines how I play this out. How many do they have? I want to burn up all their timeouts. So when I punt, they don't have the luxury of time. Where are we at when it stands with the 2 minute warning? Because that's another timeout. All of those things go into scenario. And I just hope there's an equation and a formula that is used that takes all of that stuff in. I just don't think it can be a single one dimensional approach. Like, nope.
Yeah. One size
points,
fits all.
Go. Yeah. I don't think it necessarily works like that.
I want to get your thoughts on the performance we've seen from some of these traded guys. We talked about Jamal Adams. We can move on from that one. But when you look at the receivers, Stephon Diggs and Hopkins, the success they're having right away and those teams making that aggressive move. Now, you know, obviously with the pandemic now, the value of the first round picks, we can debate that in a weird draft year. But if you just look at what they brought in, man, like it's hard to argue against the decisions that were made, the impact those two guys are having on young quarterbacks.
Yeah, and I think it's funny because that is the underrated aspect of the conversation. When you have a young quarterback, you want to bring in veteran players that already know how to play because now you have an established weapon that can get open. He understands how to handle the pressure being the number one. You can depend on him. It is harder when you pair a young quarterback with a young receiver. The odds aren't in your favor that both guys are going to be mature enough to handle the responsibilities of being franchise players, the quarterback and then the playmaker on the outside. Also, I think it is easier now when you are looking at a number one receiver and to try and figure out either how does he fit into your scheme, DeAndre Hopkins. Hey, if I walk downstairs and I talk to the head coach or the offensive coordinator, if we get DeAndre Hopkins, how will we use him? And then he'll study how he was used at Houston, and he'll say, oh, well, here's what we would do with the things that we have. Or I'm going to build it out based on what he did. What DeAndre Hopkins is doing, he's doing different stuff than he did at Houston. He is now running more hitches and quick outs and quick things designed to get the ball to him. He's using a more complete route tree. Stephon Diggs, to me, I was skeptical on the Stephon Diggs thing because I was like, man, like Stephon Diggs is such a precise route runner and Josh is such a streaky passer. Will they be able to get the value from him as a number one? But they figured it out because not only with Stephon Diggs, they got John Brown and Cole Beasley and everyone's in their assigned role, but Diggs is a terrific route runner and his ability to create what we call wide open space helps Josh Allen. And so, yes, it has worked. Credit both teams for having a clear vision for how they wanted those number one guys to be integrated into the program and into the game plan. And it has absolutely helped both young quarterbacks take another step in their development.
Yeah, it's taking their game to a whole new level. You can't argue it. I mean, it's inarguable. I want to hit one more topic with you, Buck, and I didn't tell you about this beforehand, so I'm springing this on you. But I was just thinking about this, and this is – we do hits and misses all the time, and I can give you a million guys I've missed on, and the list is a mile long. But I was thinking back to four guys that had a chance to hit on, right? Where you're, and I'm just saying that you're higher than where you got picked, right? We had them graded higher, and I know you're with me on all four of these guys because we talked about all four of them in the run-up to the draft in their drafting years. But when you look at – I want to give you these four names. Derrick Henry, DK Metcalf.
Yeah.
Mekhi Becton, Javon Kinlaw. Okay. We both had all four of those guys rated much higher than where they were selected. And what do they have in common? And I know that I don't know the better word to use. They're physical freaks. They're so much bigger, stronger, and more athletic than the average person at their position. You don't pass on freaks. You just don't do it, man. And to me, they all got nitpicked. You look at all, each of them, they got nitpicked. There aren't many guys on planet Earth that possess this combination of size and athleticism. They're rare. Don't pass on the rare guys, man.
It's funny because, you know, like you talk to a bunch of baseball guys. We've had baseball executives and scouts on the program, and traits are really big in their sport, like height, weight, speed, the metrics, like the measurable aspects of the player and prospect you can get, and you can try and project them. I think with all of those guys, Derrick Henry was big, fast, physical. You just don't see running backs coming that size. DK Metcalf was like a big, fast, physical stretch receiver. He was more straight line in his approach. But if you were a visionary, you certainly could envision him being a vertical threat, someone that could take the top off the defense because you're just asking him to do something that was well within his wheelhouse. I just believe, like, if your front office and your coaching staff are aligned, when you have these conversations, it's front office. Hey, this guy has all of the traits that you look for at the position. What is our developmental plan? Are we a team that really develops players? Are we a team of schemers? Because I think that matters. Mm-hmm. You have to scout your coaches. And I think in all of those situations, they had developmental programs that enabled those players to get on the field and to have success. And then they were willing to change some of what they did to accommodate their talents. Derrick Henry being a downhill runner, where we see the Tennessee Titans play more I formation, more under center to allow him to do his thing. And then the way that we've seen DK Metcalf emerge. But I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't think DK Metcalf was going to wear out Stephon Gilmore like that. I had a conversation with a veteran defensive coordinator about Stephon Gilmore, and they said, look, his best attributes are his instincts and his intelligence. His physical ability is not what everyone thinks as a shutdown corner. And what DK Metcalf did, he exposed that again. The speed factor is unbelievable from DK Metcalf.
But Buck, let's name this theory. It's the playground theory. If you went to a playground and you saw Derrick Henry, DK Metcalf, Mekhi Becton, Javon Kinlaw, you'd be the first pick at recess.
Give me that.
It's the playground. Don't overthink this thing. He's much bigger, much faster, much stronger than all the other kids on this playground. I'll take him.
Okay, so it's funny that you say that because we've had this conversation in a while about like scouting or whatever. Like, in theory, it really shouldn't be hard. Like, identify who the good players are. Just take good players. Like, if you go into the park and you're watching them play, go get the good player. Don't spend a lot of time, is he a good player? Can I fit him into what we do? Let's go. Like, let's keep it as simple as that. Let's just keep it simple. And I think with those things, your playground theory, when it comes to guys that are body beautiful guys who have plus traits, you got to kick the tires on. Like, even if you miss on a guy like that, you missed going for a high-end athlete who also had played and performed at a level that you could potentially see him getting better. Look, you swing and miss on those guys. What you don't swing and miss on are guys that are short, slow, non-productive that you're trying to stretch out. Like, go and get a guy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, my definition of somebody that fits in this category is you don't see one every year.
No.
I haven't seen a running back like Derrick Henry going back to probably to Brandon Jacobs.
Brandon Jacobs is much faster than Brandon Jacobs.
You know, with DK Metcalf, I mean, you get a receiver like that probably once every, you know, I don't know, 7-8 years. You see a guy that's just that physically big and strong and fast. Mekhi Becton is a, you know, I compared him to McKinney, to Bryant McKinney, like guys that have that size and skill set, they don't come around, but every so often. Javon Kinlaw is another example. And we had Javon Kinlaw in the top 10, probably should have had him even higher, probably in the top 5 when it's all said and done. We look back on it because he's so tall and long and strong and explosive. Like that, he's when you're comparing guys like Richard Seymour, these guys don't come around very often, man. No. So I don't understand sometimes. And you know what? I know he's been injured, and that may be factored into why he dropped. But Derwin James would be another example of just somebody at that size.
And that's the one that I struggle with, because I'm looking at him, and I'm biased because having watched him since he was 16, 17, and known what the makeup is, I couldn't believe, like, on draft day, I'm like, man, I cannot believe this dude. Like, what am I missing? Am I too close to the fire? Because, like, this dude has everything that you want. He's big. He's fast. He's physical. He's instinctive. He's tough. He loves the game. He has playmaking ability. Man, why am I off? And I just had the toughest time understanding that. And I do believe that those freaks, you have to grade them accordingly, and you have to have enough imagination to be able to articulate how this player is going to perform at the next level.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating to me. But anyways, that was a fun discussion. That's what I love about the pod, is we weren't even talking about this coming into the show, but then it's funny.
So
fun talk.
Another guy that I would kind of put in there, because DJ, Lamar Jackson, right?
Like, that's another great example. Like, he's just different.
Like Lamar Jackson, Kyler Murray. I mean, I guess we could throw Pat Mahomes in it. They all are kind of freakish in the way that they perform. And because they were, I would say, so different from the traditional quarterback that we've seen, it makes it hard to kind of issue out that grade. Now, Pat Mahomes, we knew about the arm talent, but like his game was unorthodox based on how he played at Texas Tech. Lamar Jackson, when you watch, you're like, man, like, I don't know if I've ever seen this work in the league. Like he runs around or whatever. But DJ, like, I'm going to read some to you. This dude is the first quarterback in NFL history to have 45 touchdowns and fewer than 10 interceptions in their first 600 pass attempts. Do you know who else is in the company with fewer than 20 interceptions? Mahomes, Dan Marino, and Kurt Warner. That's it. Like, and so, like, now we go back and you're like, man, like, a bottom of the first round grade? Like,
I know.
He rushed for 1,500 yards in back-to-back years, won a Heisman, did all this stuff, had a duel with Deshaun Watson where he was the better player. And
He made Louisville relevant, which they had not been for a very long time. But, I mean, like, and to me, you can look at some other guys, like when Gronk came out, and that was his back. Yeah, that's kind of what he felt, but he's a physical freak. You know, Quentin Nelson went high. I mean, he was a top 10 pick, but he was a physical freak at Notre Dame. So it's those guys. Don't pass on those guys, man. Don't do it.
God, it's fascinating to watch. But you know what happens? Those freaks pave the way for the next generation of freaks, because we won't make the mistake. The next quarterback or next playmaker that shows hints of those skills that the aforementioned guys have shown, we'll jump all over those. Like, that's what happens.
Yep.
Like, Russell Wilson paved the way for Kyler Murray to be able to exist. By the way, did you see his touchdown with the skip to my Lou stutter step? And then dancing. I think he's found his mojo as a runner this year, because he didn't show that last year. But this year, he is fully embracing all that he is as a player.
How good is the pinky promise looking?
Oh man, we take that to the bank. Got seven spots. Seven spots to get to the playoffs?
Yeah. I'm feeling good about it.
I'm
feeling very good about it. All right. Let me handle some business here. Let you guys know you can stream live and local primetime games for free on your phone and tablet by downloading the NFL app or Yahoo Sports app. So give you a heads up on that one. We've had some fun podcasts over the last year, and it got me thinking about the baseball podcast that we did as we're going towards the postseason. We had a chance to have Jed Hoyer on from the Cubs, who are going to go to the postseason. We had, Mattingly was on, who's done a great job.
Yeah, Dave Roberts.
With the Marlins. Dave Roberts, again, the Dodgers, the best team in baseball right now. Thad Levine with the Twins, they're going to go to the postseason. So we got a chance. If you want a little baseball flavor as you go towards the postseason, go back in the archive and find the Move the Sticks podcast we did, the Winter Meetings edition, where we talked to a lot of these guys that are having success this year. And I thought they gave us kind of the blueprint for their plans, and that it's kind of cool to look back on that now that we're heading towards the playoffs.
It is really cool. And I mean, I think this year more than any other year, we really dug into what I call cross-training, trying to look at other sports, looking at other team building models, scouting models, to kind of see how we can pick their brains and kind of incorporate it with what we do. And I think man, this baseball podcast is one of the best when it comes to giving you insight into how they think, how they go about building their teams, how they evaluate and kind of sort out the top prospects from the others. And so, look, I would encourage everybody to listen. It is great insight and a different perspective on how championship squads are built.
I want to add this. We've encouraged you guys to leave us ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts. You guys have done that. We're getting close to 2,000 on there on the ratings, I believe. So go ahead and hop on there. Get us over that number. It would be great. You guys have been leaving us the best high school football player you've ever seen, which we've got some great names. Some new ones that have popped up on there. You guys gave us Adrian Peterson, Tyler Boyd, Daron Harmon, interesting one, Chase Winovich. And then Darnell Savage. So those are some of the names of some of the best high school football players you guys have ever seen. So if you haven't done it already, hop on there, give us a rating review, let us know the best high school football player that you've ever seen. Anything you want to add here, Buck, before we roll out of here?
Nah, just make sure you check out all of our content, our video content. Go to NFL.com/MTSvideo and YouTube.com/NFL podcast. Make sure you check out what we got.
Inspired by ongoing conversations with players, the NFL launched NFL Votes to empower and improve our communities by exercising the right to vote. Join the NFL family by registering to vote today and make your voice heard this November. Visit NFL.com/votes to learn more. That's going to do it for us today. I want to thank you guys so much for listening to Move the Sticks, presented by Zaxby's.